Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. After enduring the worst natural disaster in Pakistan's history, survivors of the earthquake there are now being threatened by another killer, the Himalayan winter. The temperature is dropping in the mountain villages where an estimated 3 million people have been left homeless by the quake. We're joined now by BBC correspondent Owen Bennett-Jones in Islamabad. And Owen, first, give us the latest on the relief efforts. What's going on the ground?
What's going on is that the relief effort is gearing up, but it is just such a huge challenge. I've been speaking to UN officials here who say this is bigger than the tsunami in terms of the logistical demands being made upon them. That's really because of the weather. It's going to get very cold in the coming months. It's because of the geography. These are some of the deepest valleys and highest mountains in the world. It's because of the roads. They don't exist anymore. There are places in which roads, 10-kilometer stretches of them, have just slipped down the mountain. It's going to take years to rebuild them. There are huge problems. There are 3 million people without homes now, and the effort, as I say, is gearing up. But frankly, they've got a long way to go before they can reach all the affected people.
We're hearing reports, because these people aren't being reached, they're mostly being amputated once they are reached, and that mules are being used to bring supplies to remote villages. Have you seen that?
Yeah, sure. I went out with some mules and we saw them set off into the mountains. It's a very practical way of doing it. I mean, normally they're used to carry artillery pieces up to the high point so that the Pakistanis can trade artillery fire with the Indian forces across the line of control. But they're being used for a humanitarian purpose now. They have a number of advantages. They can deliver door to door. The helicopters have problems in the rough weather, but also just dropping aid in places where there are a lot of trees and where there are no places to land. So the mules are quite practical, and they're being used. I mean, boats are being used. Boy Scouts are going out on feet with rucksacks taking aid. Religious militant groups are sending out their workers into various parts of the Pakistan-occupied Kashmir to reach villages and to try and persuade people that they're on their side and so on, a bit of a political element in it. And so everyone is using basically every means possible to get to these remote villages.
Speaking of the political element, we hear that Islamic militant groups have been aiding the relief efforts sooner in many cases than the Pakistani government.
Yeah, that's right. I heard that they were present in the Neelam Valley, which is one of the areas that's cut off. You can only get there on foot. And one of the, you know, more radical groups, Lashkar-e-Toiba, banned by the United States. In fact, I even heard the suggestion, I can't confirm this, but apparently at one place, the Lashkar-e-Toiba guys were working shoulder to shoulder with some Americans, which is quite remarkable since Lashkar-e-Toiba is a banned organization by the State Department. And it would have been a remarkable thing to see. I don't know if the Americans knew who they were working with. But yes, certainly the militant groups have got a presence on the ground. They're there anyway. A lot of the militant training camps are around Muzaffarabad, and they're certainly present and making it very clear that they're present. A lot of flags, a lot of banners, making it clear that they're trying to help the people.
In the meantime, the people, we mentioned so many of them just having limbs amputated because it's taking so long to get to them. Owen, do you have any sense of how many people may die because it's so hard to reach them?
Well, I think more will die, and I think more have died than we know about. The official death toll is now over 50,000. Now, it started at just over 10,000. To be fair to the Pakistan government, in the first few hours of this catastrophe, they had absolutely no contact with the whole affected area. I spoke to the Prime Minister, who said, look, we only had two sat phones working, and that was the only connection between the capital and the earthquake zone. So they didn't have a handle on what had gone on, and I'm not convinced that they have yet, really. I've spoken to UN officials who say, off the record, they believe the final death toll could go as high as 120,000. I mean, this is a massive catastrophe.
Right. And Owen, for you, you've been bringing us these firsthand reports in the last 9-plus days. Can you give us a sense of what you're seeing? I mean, the enormity of it, the people.
Well, they're suffering, and the fact is they've got no money. I mean, this is, you know, how I see it, is that the UN is saying it's going to be 10 years before they sort this out, the reconstruction effort. The Prime Minister says 5 years. Well, I mean, okay, let's say more than 10 years. And where are they going to live? You know, they've got no homes. These are people who do not have a lot of money. They're basically subsistence farming. So their homes have gone. They're living in the open. It's getting snowy. And they face a very bleak future. I mean, the best that could happen to them is that they live in refugee camps for years. I mean, that's the best outcome.
What does this do to the region, which was already fighting over, you know, the disputed territory of Kashmir?
Interesting that. I mean, I wonder whether any of this aid, if it comes, and, you know, frankly, normally it doesn't, but I mean, if it does come, will it be conditional on some kind of progress in the Kashmir dispute? You know, this is, you know, a very sensitive part of the world, and this is right on the line of control. In some places, the line itself, the barbed wire fence that divides the Indian and PAK forces, has actually disappeared. It's broken up. So what's going to happen? I imagine that as the weeks go by, the Pakistan side will say, look, we don't want lots of foreigners crawling around this place. We don't know who you all are, and we want to have control over this. And that's going to complicate the relief effort. So I think, you know, in terms of the politics, it's going to get trickier than it is now.
Owen Bennett-Jones, correspondent for the BBC and author of Pakistan, The Eye of the Storm. Owen, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Take care. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald is expected to hand out indictments this week in the case of Valerie Plame, the covert CIA operative whose identity was exposed to journalists. Investigators are trying to determine if anyone in the White House intentionally leaked Plame's identity as retribution against her husband, Joseph Wilson, who'd been a vocal critic of claims of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Well, the case has also raised questions about coverage in the New York Times. Reporter Judith Miller spent 85 days in jail rather than reveal a source for an article she never wrote. Today, Miller received a First Amendment Award from the Society of Professional Journalists for taking that stance. Kai Plaskan of KNPR Public Radio is at the convention in Las Vegas. He joins us now briefly. Kai, we're going to hear some critics of Judith Miller in just a moment, but I understand she addressed critics or rumors speaking today. What did she say?
Yes, Robin. First, she started out by saying that she couldn't have done 30 years worth of stories without these confidential sources. She started, and she went on to talk about these rumors, saying that they were taking on a life of their own, that she didn't go to jail to protect any wrongdoing, and she's not partisan, and she didn't do it to get a book deal. And against the advice of her lawyer, she decided to speak in the Times about her experience.
And how is she being received in the room?
She is being received warmly. There was a standing ovation when she stood up to give her speech, but afterwards it was just a warm applause.
That's Kai Plaskan of KNPR at a convention in Las Vegas, where New York Times reporter Judith Miller is receiving the First Amendment Award today. Kai, thank you.
Yes, and tomorrow she will testify before the Federal Judiciary Committee in favor of a shield law as well. Thank you.
There you go. Thanks, Kai. Well, as we said, Judith Miller also has her critics who ask, was she too close to cover this story? Has she become too renegade a reporter in the New York Times newsroom? She and the Times tried to address these questions in the paper Sunday in articles that raised more questions for many. Joining us now, Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and Seth Mnookin, author of Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. And Seth, I want to start with you. Some journalists are calling for Miller to be fired for obstructing coverage. Do you think that's fair?
Probably what will happen is that she will not be fired. You know, no one's going to come to her and say, you're terminated as of today, but they will figure out a way to create a situation in which her name never appears as the author of an article in the New York Times again. There's so much frustration and resentment and distrust towards her within the Times that it's hard for me to imagine a situation in which she appears back there as an employee.
Are reporters telling you that?
Reporters and editors there are telling me that.
Well, you know, some are saying that this should have happened a long time ago, Judith Miller's name being removed from the byline, because of her reporting on weapons of mass destruction. And remember that Judith Miller was pivotal in the Times reporting of the White House claims of weapons of mass destruction. Let's remind ourselves of that, Tom.
She persuaded and was sort of the leader at the Times of coverage that seemed to confirm that there was strong evidence of the existence of these weapons. The Times was sufficiently embarrassed by the work in retrospect that they took the extraordinary step of publishing an editor's note, in effect apologizing for a lack of skepticism in their reporting, and all but one of the articles that they referred to were either authored or co-authored by Judith Miller.
Yeah, and to remind ourselves, Judith Miller was embedded with soldiers looking for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. She was given special security clearance. Seth Mnookin, back to you. Now they're saying no more writing on that topic, but should she have been the one to be focused on the Wilson story?
No, she probably shouldn't have, because as several people at the Times have pointed out to me, at the point that this discrediting campaign or this theoretical discrediting campaign was going on, she had as much to gain by discrediting critics of the war effort as the Bush administration did. Her whole professional career was now sort of hinging on whether she was essentially duped in some of the most important reporting of the last couple of years. Was she someone who was bringing the proper degree of skepticism and critical lens to the information that she was given, or did she, in essence, become so invested in this story that she turned into a bit of a propagandist? That's why Bill Keller said, when he took over the paper, one of the first things he said was that Judy should not write about Iraq and WMDs. Certainly a very good question, a question that's been asked, is why then she drifted back, and that's Keller's verb, to addressing those issues, and that's one of the reasons that the paper has taken this hit.
But the questions that you're asking really relate to prior to Keller's term, and he, in effect, the paper has addressed that in its own editor's note and acknowledged that, yeah, they lacked skepticism and they were used.
Right. For Keller, he would have been in a more tenable position if from July 2003 on, Judy wrote about whatever she wrote about, but that did not include Iraq, weapons, the war, and in fact, if you go and do a byline search, she did continue to write about
right.
those things.
So I think the question for Keller now is, why a reporter who was basically forbidden from covering this issue, why, if she was allowed to drift back into it, and then why, when that work, although not published, got them into this legal and public situation,
right.
they allowed her almost complete discretion to determine what the Times' policies
right.
were. That, from a management standpoint, seems, frankly, almost surreal.
One of the most troublesome quotes in the Times' own account is from publisher Arthur Sulzberger, and he said, you know, Judy's hand was on the wheel because this was her car that she was driving, essentially.
Right.
And that's a very, very frightening and dangerous thing to say when you're talking about a reporter who already had all these questions raised. The fact that not only were they letting her essentially dictate the paper's policy, but as we now found out, none of the top editors had gone over her notes with her
right.
or tried to figure out exactly what she had done and what she had learned.
This is the focus now of attention inside the Times and,
right.
and inside the journalism community.
Will we see
right.
an editor be fired at the Times?
Absolutely not.
I would put that this way, and I would completely agree.
You're
the
right.
Judy Miller case is about Judy Miller.
That's Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. We're also talking to Seth Mnookin, author of Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. When we come back, we'll continue to look at how the Times covered the case of Valerie Plame and what's also being called the case of Judith Miller. Stay there. Much more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and today we're talking about the fallout of the New York Times over reporter Judith Miller's involvement in the Valerie Plame case. Now, Miller went to jail for 85 days rather than reveal her source, which many fellow journalists found admirable. Others say she shouldn't have been on the story in the first place. Judith Miller was criticized much earlier for relying too heavily on White House sources for her reporting on weapons of mass destruction in the run-up to the Iraq War, particularly her reliance on Iraqi exile Ahmed Shalabi, whose claims of WMD have since been widely discredited. Well, we're speaking today with Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, and Seth Mnookin, author of Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. And Seth, many reporters at the New York Times have complained in the Valerie Plame case, which centered on a CIA agent's name but also is about weapons of mass destruction, that their stories were squashed and the paper was scooped because of Judith Miller's involvement in this story. Have reporters told you that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's really one of the biggest issues and one of the areas in which the Times is getting the most criticism, and rightly so. The reason why that was is because when Judy sort of tried to position herself as a First Amendment martyr, she backed the paper a little bit into a hole because there was no really feasible way for them not to support her. In other words, if you're going to say that you're going to support your reporters and their right to protect sources, you can't only do that when the reporter is less controversial than Judy Miller and when the potential source is less troubling than Scooter Libby. And because of that, they were in a position where it really would have been difficult for them to report on the complexities of this case if that involved either endangering a reporter of theirs who was in jail, possibly inciting or frustrating the special prosecutor, or revealing a source that she had obviously proven herself willing to be incarcerated to protect. So that's why they were a little bit hamstrung. The downside, the obvious downside of that, is what this special prosecutor is investigating is potentially crimes committed by senior White House aides. And the New York Times, one of the best journalistic institutions in the country, was limited in its ability to report on the possibility of crimes being committed in the White House. And that's obviously a huge problem.
And in the big piece that came out on Sunday, the reporters who wrote the piece seemed frustrated with Judith Miller's lack of cooperation on their story. She didn't share her notes with reporters or editors.
I'd say that's a frustration is an understatement for what they were feeling. I mean, not only did she not share her notes, she didn't agree to write her own account until late on Friday, which then caused the paper and the reporters at the paper to need to go out and re-report parts of what they had already finished. That, in turn, meant that the entire package couldn't appear in the Bulldog edition of the Sunday paper, which is...
The Bulldog?
The Bulldog edition, which is printed and put out on the streets of New York City on Saturday evening, and has a distribution of about 100,000 copies. So there was a lot of frustration with Judy and how she specifically handled the reporting of this package, and that obviously only added to the resentment and frustration that people there were already feeling.
This comes as the New York Times Company recently announced plans to cut about 4% of its workforce. That means about 500 jobs at two publications, the New York Times and the Boston Globe here in Boston.
Right.
How is this affecting the bottom line, if at all?
I don't think that you're going to see a huge impact of this scandal on the bottom line. And I say that mainly from my reporting on the Jason Blair scandal, which certainly got as much attention as this did, and in some ways was probably a little easier for people to understand because that just involved outright fraud as opposed to these other murky issues. With Jason, you didn't see a drop in circulation, you didn't see a drop in advertising, and you didn't see a drop in subscribers to the New York Times News Service. So I doubt that there's going to be the kind of immediate short-term impact on the bottom line that investors will look at and get worried about. On the other hand, you know, the big issue for the American media today is its reliability and its place in a world where information is so much easier to come by. And the sort of drumbeat of scandals such as this is not helping media or journalism's long-term image.
But Tom Rosenstiel, I want to ask you, does the New York Times perhaps rebound better because of the way it does its self-examining and its mea culpas and puts on the hair shirt?
Well, I think that it's important to make a distinction between the way they handled this and the way they handled the Jason Blair story. Part of what propelled the Blair story and led to the ultimate ouster of the editor Hal Raines and the managing editor Gerald Boyd was that the initial account in the paper exonerated management from any culpability in what Jason Blair had done, even though the facts of the story clearly contradicted that. And it looked as though in the pages of the paper there was an attempt at a whitewash. Here you have something very different. The you know, that story on Sunday was sort of a long stare into the soul of the New York Times. We saw deep divisions in the paper. We saw the managing editor accusing, effectively calling Judy Miller a liar. We saw the managing editor, Jill Abramson, regretting almost everything about what the Times, how the Times had handled the entire case. There's a real difference there. The other thing that's important, other distinction I think is important, is that what's coming into question here in terms of the decision-making of Bill Keller and Arthur Sulzberger is their handling of a legal issue, not what appeared in the pages of the paper.
Gentlemen, we're going to leave it at that. Tom Rosensteel is director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. Seth Mnookin, author of Hard News, The Scandals at the New York Times and Their Meaning for American Media. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, what do you think? As always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, as Saddam Hussein goes on trial, we'll speak to a young woman who grew up in his inner circle. She was his pilot's daughter and lived a life of privilege and abject fear. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As the death toll of U.S. soldiers in Iraq climbs to 2,000, the number of wounded also rises. According to the Defense Department, around 15,000 Americans have been wounded since the beginning of the war in Iraq. And we were struck recently by a story in the Washington Post that detailed the experience of several wounded U.S. soldiers. They returned home to find they owed the U.S. Army money because of glitches in the military pay system. One congressman called it financial-friendly fire. Well, there is now a group that's trying to help these soldiers. It's called the Wounded Warrior Project. Earlier this year, the group helped pass a bill that provides extra insurance protection for soldiers with traumatic injuries, and now they're also trying to clear their debts. We've got a couple members on the line. Co-founder of that group, former Marine John Melia, joins us. John, I understand you were injured in Somalia.
I was in a helicopter crash off the coast of Somalia in 1992, before the conflict there.
Okay, well, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Army Staff Sergeant Heath Calhoun. He got help from the Wounded Warrior Project that John helped start after Heath lost both legs in a rocket-propelled grenade attack in Iraq in 2003. Heath, welcome to you as well.
Well, thank you very much, ma'am.
And we understand you now work for the Wounded Warrior Project?
Yes, ma'am. I'm the outreach coordinator for the Wounded Warrior Project.
Okay. Now. And apparently you've got a lot of work to do because, John, let's explain what's happening here. Soldiers, we understand, are paid more during combat. They're paid less when they're not in combat and less when they're wounded and out of action. But computers sometimes don't understand that. Explain.
Exactly. There has been a significant amount of difficulty. We can count the numbers, probably in the hundreds of service members that have been affected by the pay problems associated with returning from combat and having their pay reduced. Also things like their equipment being left in the combat zone after they were injured, mm-hmm. and the military's trying to charge them for loss of that equipment.
Because we understand the military computer system is outdated and doesn't catch up, so it's still charging soldiers for equipment they may no longer have?
Well, exactly. You know, the situation is this. The pay system has been, they've been trying to change the pay system since the 80s. So they've identified it as a broken system since the 80s. So it's an old, old military pay system. And just like the FBI is having trouble putting an information technology platform online, the military is having the same type of issues. This is a huge bureaucracy, and it's like turning a battleship sometimes to get these types of things changed. But it's causing significant problems for a number of wounded service members, and we identified those problems, and we're trying to work with the GAO and the military to ensure that there's a fix.
Well, Heath, you're doing some outreach. Give us an example, if you could synopsize, of a soldier who is home wounded, and what might he get billed for? How much might it be?
The costs vary due to soldier to soldier. What we've seen that they're billing for is a lot of the equipment that the soldiers have taken over to combat with them, and due to their injury, were not able to bring back and turn back in. It can be up into the thousands, a couple thousand dollars, depending on that the particular soldier and the particular amount of equipment, what kind of unit he's in.
And these are soldiers who are, you know, in hospitals, missing limbs, who are trying to, you know, pay their rent, keep up their family with these new injuries, and they get these bills?
Unfortunately, like we just discussed, it does happen. And the best thing that they can try to do right now at this moment is try to fix the problem.
Well, we understand that the Army has tried, at least in the last few months, to have a database of injured troops so that they can prevent, you know, so they can keep from sending bills to these troops. But in the meantime, the bills are still coming. John, what's that like? I mean, what are you hearing from soldiers that that's like to open a bill?
Keith and I were with one of those particular soldiers when he got one of those bills, and I think the first thing that we both agree on was that this particular soldier was angry. He said, you know, I lost my leg in Iraq, and they're trying to charge me for equipment. It's ridiculous. And the biggest problem is not necessarily the bill, because you can work that out. The biggest problem we've seen is that, you know, when the military can't collect the debt, or it takes a while to collect the debt, they put it on the person's credit report. And that can be a significant problem and can cause some serious problems for the military service member. You know, we had a young man in Alabama who about a year and a half ago, when the hurricanes came through Alabama, the family lost their home, and as a stopgap he was trying to get an apartment. Unfortunately, the military had created one of these debts, and he was not able to get an apartment because his credit was dinged.
Well, I'm wondering if your group, I mean, I can hear people listening to this and saying, this is incredible. Is there a way to push for some kind of legislation so that even if a soldier's getting billed for his flak jacket or his helmet, okay, we have to keep track of things, it doesn't go to a credit agency?
Well, I think that's a big piece. I mean, I don't know that we need to get legislation passed, but I think we certainly should try to put some type of a program in place that would ensure that wounded soldiers, when they're identified as wounded, they don't necessarily need to be forgiven of the debts. Some of the debts, you know, as Heath was explaining this morning to me, are justifiable. Some of them have to do with moving out of their military housing, and there was, just like you would move out of an apartment, there may have been damage to the property from dogs or something like that, and they, you know, the service member actually owed a particular debt. You know, there are justifiable debts that need to be paid. The problem is, a lot of times, the last thing that they need to be worrying about is paying a debt. I mean, there should be some period of forgiveness, or maybe total forgiveness of the debt, or there should at least be a situation where, you know, the soldier is forgiven for a period of time, at least until that person's rehabilitation is finished up.
Yeah. Heath, I mentioned earlier you lost both legs in Iraq, and you now work with the Wounded Warrior Project.
Yes, ma'am.
I somewhat wonder, how do you do this? How do you, you know, go through this experience and then, you know, see these little indignities inflicted on other soldiers? I mean, you know, it's a computer screw-up. They happen all the time, but this is happening to somebody who's, you know, given so much. How does it make you feel about the military? How are you processing this?
I'm not going to try to come here and tell you that the military is completely unflawed. But I love the military, otherwise I wouldn't have joined, and, you know, I love my country, and I hate to see that the problems arise, but I'm glad to know that they're trying to fix the problems and that there's people out there that are trying to fix the problems that do arise.
John, you also, we mentioned, injured in Somalia. You started this Wounded Warrior Project. Why did you start it?
Well, I felt like there was a problem in the transition between military service and civilian life. So what the project tried to do was identify these wounded folks while they're still in the hospital bed so that we can keep track of them and help to kind of smooth the transition process from military life to civilian life. You know, I think if people had been more proactive during Vietnam, we may not have seen some of the transitional problems that Vietnam vets faced. And we wanted to ensure that this generation, this newest generation of wounded heroes was taken care of.
John Melia, co-founder of the Wounded Warrior Project, a former Marine. We also spoke with Heath Calhoun. He lost two legs in Iraq and now works with the organization. For more on the Wounded Warrior Project, how you might participate, go to our website, here-now.org. Officials in the city of Taunton, Massachusetts, just south of where we are in Boston, are closely monitoring a nearly 200-year-old wooden dam that is close to breaching because of 7 inches of rain that fell over the weekend. If that dam breaks, a wall of water 6 feet deep could flood the city, which is just, as I said, south of us. 2,000 residents were evacuated yesterday, and schools are closed today. Here's Taunton Mayor Robert Nunes.
The city of Taunton is still in a state of emergency. The condition of the dam at Wittington Mills has not deteriorated significantly over the past several hours.
Good news to people in Taunton. Joining us on the line from there is WBUR's Martha Biebinger. And Martha, so the situation hasn't really deteriorated that much in several hours, according to the mayor. But what does that mean? Is the water level going down, still rising?
No, it is going down, Robin. That's right. There's been some runoff. There is also water coming through the dam where it is leaking, and that is relieving pressure on the dam, which officials seem to be somewhat hopeful will mean that it will hold.
They were hoping earlier today that it would run off, like sort of like a bathtub, as opposed to breaking
dam.
Well, there was a voluntary evacuation yesterday. Officials saying anything new about how it went, because we know there was a huge traffic jam.
Right. Right. We know that part of the evacuation plan needs some tweaking. But the people who have been evacuated apparently are taking everything in stride. They're at work today, or there are activities for some of the kids at Taunton High School this afternoon. There seems to be a fairly optimistic note here that the officials have done the right things in terms of taking precautions. I did go by one senior housing complex where a woman whose mother had left her cat in the complex was crying and pleading with officers. So you're going to see that kind of scene anytime there's an evacuation. But for the most part, it seems to have gone very smoothly.
Well, and other cities with mill towns across the country are watching because there's a lot of these old dams out there.
Oh,
this,
yes.
This one was privately owned. We know it had been recently inspected. Is it thought
That's
that
right.
it had, you know, it's done what it's supposed to do to be maintained?
Yes, to be maintained, but that is different than being ready to handle the accumulation of 10 inches of rain in a week. And as you said, just in Massachusetts, we have a lot of these dams, over 3,000, the governor said today. And so he and the legislature will now take a look at whether the inspection standards that have been set for dams and the kinds of requirements for upkeep are adequate.
Yeah, and is there any sense that this one will be rebuilt? Can it be just rebuilt?
They have not done a structural assessment at this point to find out whether that's true, and in part that's because they don't know what it'll look like next week.
Yeah. WBUR's Martha Biebinger, she's reporting from Taunton, Massachusetts, where people are holding their breath, hoping that that water will continue to recede and the dam will not break. Martha, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, joining us now is Sean Lugie. He's manager of Wittington Hardware and Gifts in Taunton. Sean, how far are you from the dam?
The store is about 3/8 of a mile higher ground. My house is a mile downstream right in the path.
Oh, what kind of water effect did you have there?
So far, the water's just risen up right to the end of the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
But if that dam does go, then, I mean, I would expect it to come into the cellar.
Yeah, well, or maybe worse. Now, we understand you've been evacuated?
Yes, I was evacuated last night.
How'd that go?
Well, for me, it went fairly smooth, but I guess they did have some problems. Confusion, people didn't know where to go. A lot of them ended up at the high school. I was fortunate. I was able to stay with a relative.
Right, and you also have the store, which I'm wondering, how are things at the hardware store?
Today, it's actually very busy. We're the only place open, so all the other places are low-lying. They were shut down in the state of emergency. They're treating this worse than a winter storm.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you there, Sean.
Okay, thank you.
Sean Lugie, manager of the Wittington Hardware and Gift Store in Taunton, Massachusetts, speaking to us about the dam just less than a mile away, threatening to break. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and now a mature discussion of the body. Eve Ensler made one part of the body, the vagina, a star, the centerpiece of her stage play, The Vagina Monologues, which moved women around the world to talk about their vaginas and led to an international movement to make people aware of and prevent violence against women. It even has its own day, V-Day. But as Eve writes in the introduction to her new work, you'd think that after becoming comfortable with my vagina, I could relax, get on with life. But this was not the case. The deadly self-hatred simply moved into another part of my body. Here she reads her own words, some of which may not be suitable for all listeners.
What I can't believe is that someone like me, a radical feminist for nearly 30 years, that I could spend this much time thinking about my stomach. It has become my tormentor, my distractor, my most serious, committed relationship. It has protruded through my clothes, my confidence, and my ability to work. I've tried to sedate it, educate it, embrace it, but most of all, erase it.
Eve Ensler reading from The Good Body, her newest play, in which she examines the extremes women go to achieve an impossible, though much advertised, standard of beauty. And Eve joins us from St. Paul, Minnesota, with more. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, do I read correctly that you actually kept a journal of your inner dialogue with your stomach?
Yes, I did. I had a journal where I was in dialogue with my belly for about, actually, 2 years. You know, I was so shocked to see myself obsessing about my stomach. I think part of what we really need to do is be in dialogue with that part of ourselves and bring consciousness to it, because it's most illuminating.
Well, tell me, what did you think about your stomach? I mean, I've met you. You're a beautiful woman. I have not seen your stomach. But what was it about it?
It was that it was not flat. It was flabby. It was out of my control. Mm-hmm. Do you know, I think once you hit 40 as a woman, your body changes, and then 50, it really changes. And no matter what you do, it has a life of its own. And it was really this desire to really investigate what that self-hatred was based on. Every woman I talk to, bar none, except for maybe a couple of really enlightened women in Africa and India, just about every single woman I talked to on this journey hated one particular part of her body.
You also found that you had issues with food, perhaps related to your parents. Your mother was beautiful. And
blonde and perfect.
Yeah, there you go. And you didn't feel you could live up to that.
Mm-mm.
I think
there was this aesthetic in my family. My parents were gorgeous. And on the outside, everything looked really perfect. And inside, it was a completely different story. So I think our bodies often manifest and take in all that we can't express, and they begin to be the places, sort of the repository for all that shame and confusion and doubt and self-hatred. And, you know, I grew up in a very violent family, both sexually and physically. And, you know, I think, you know, for a long time, I didn't really live in my body. I had separated, kind of disassociated from myself early on after all the abuse. And when I finally came back into my body, then it was like, oh, I see why I haven't been here. I get why I took off. What's really fascinating to me is it really doesn't have a lot to do, in many cases, with reality. You know, often the thing that women hate the most about themselves is the most beautiful and the most unique and the thing that makes them exactly who they are. And that's the thing they're desperate to get rid of or shrink or die or fix.
Well, let's talk about some of the women that you spoke with. Women who are trying to lose weight at fat camps. On another occasion, you went to a clinic in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. Where they were doing what?
Well, it was a vaginal laser rejuvenation center, and where women were basically tightening their vaginas and trimming their labia majora and minora to make them more symmetrical, which, by the way, is a fastly growing business. And I spent 2 weeks in the center interviewing women. I spent time in surgery watching the surgery. I spent time with the women before the surgery. I was in a vulva support group, if you can believe there's such a thing. You know, one of the things I always say about this whole journey is I would have all these judgments, and then I would get there, and either I would be so moved by why women felt compelled, or I'd feel like in Rio, I was like, lipo, maybe a good idea. Because any place that you're in, within the context of it, it makes complete sense, you know? The tragic ending of this play is I'll go to Rio, and I'll finish with lipo, which will be the anti-feminist ending, but I didn't end up doing that. But,
no, in fact, you end up in Afghanistan. You recount a story of eating ice cream there. I mean, it seemed like the most extreme version of what you've been talking about throughout this. Women can actually be killed in Kabul if they're caught eating ice cream.
Yes, and it was true because it was perceived as lascivious. You know, there are moments in your life where you go, wow. I'm sitting in a place, you know, in a little town called Jalalabad, which was actually the stronghold of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, in a little bazaar with the Taliban circling in their pickup trucks, in a back room with sheets pulled around us, as this woman was eating ice cream. And I was thinking to myself, it is the year 2000 and whatever, and there's a place on the planet where it's illegal to eat ice cream. You know, it was truly, and yet women are extraordinary because they had found a way to keep their sexuality and their pleasure and their desire alive. They had found a place where they could go to eat ice cream.
Well, and as you write, and you being there, finally, my being fat is clearly less important than being free. I eat the ice cream. It reminds me that, I mean, what I took away from that is that we, American women, we're our own Taliban. We do it to ourselves, whereas in this other country, they had to have a dictatorship to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's that that myth of women in the West being liberated and compared to women in the rest of the world, which I always take great issue with. You know, the forms of oppression in the West are much more sophisticated. In Africa, when they end the tradition of female genital mutilation, it will be over. It will be done. Women there actually like their bodies. They didn't have that cellular injection from the time they're five, you know, to feel like they need to look a certain way. That seems to me much harder to overcome because it's psychological and it's imprinted in your DNA. It's a much harder thing to get through than ending a certain tradition which is cutting off a part of your body. And I think we need to be really aware in the West, not only how oppressed we all are and under this tyranny, but how profoundly and massively we are exporting that around the world.
Eve Ensler speaking about her new play, The Good Body. And I'm wondering, how do you feel about your tummy now?
You know, I have my days where I look at myself and I look 52, and that's interesting. But it's not awful anymore. And what I will say is something's changed in me. I think that I've come to really love my body. I think what I'm learning is that the more we can turn that self-hatred into a form of service and into usefulness, the more relieved we are of the burden of it.
Eve Ensler of The Vagina Monologues and now The Good Body, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. I've loved talking to you.
And for more on Eve's tour, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Karen Miller-Medson, Vince Fairchild, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugarts is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our interns are Jessica Gerard, Angela Kim, and Lara Farrar. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.